good evening, everybody. My name is Merv, and I'm an alcoholic. And by the grace of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been sober since June 1st of 2001. And my home group is the Buckingham Big Book Group. We meet on Tuesday nights at 8 o'clock in Buckingham Courthouse. If anybody ever wants to come, we always have a caravan that likes to go down. So, you know, we always have an open chair and a hot pot of coffee. So please join us sometime. I don't know, you know. Generally in meetings, I do pretty well at sharing about 5 minutes, and then that's about all anybody gets out of me, you know, at one time. So for me to come up here and tell my story, I'll try and keep it as pinpoint as possible. But then again, I will not end it at half an hour either, so I'll try my best. So, I don't know, you know, like most alcoholics, you know, I think, you know, whenever I have those early memories of my childhood, you know, I had a lot of stuff going on early in my life, and even before I had my first drink of alcohol. You know, I grew up in a central Pennsylvania town, and the town was one of those out-of-work steel mill towns that you always hear about up in Pennsylvania. The unemployment rate was right around 40%. There were definitely more bars than there were stores. And that was just the kind of community that I was brought up in. You know, I had good, honest, hardworking parents. You know, we were definitely lower middle class to poor. But they did whatever they could to bring home and give us kids, you know, like a happy life. They tried their darndest. And I had three older sisters. And, you know, and these three older sisters of mine did a majority of the raising of me for a portion of my childhood. Growing up, you know, it's funny as I look back, but I was pretty much sure that my dad was an alcoholic. You know, I mean, he was always, you know, he had the characteristics of alcoholism, you know, like he liked to hang out in bars and spend his paycheck there and stuff like that. And, you know, and my mom was kind of like the same way. My mom, you know, she liked to go out and have fun too. And my mom was, you know, a very nervous character, and you know, what she liked to do was, like, basically use a lot of stuff out of the medicine cabinet all the time. My mom was always pretty well sedated. So growing up, you know, before I've even had my first taste of alcohol, you know, I was already aware of what alcohol was doing, you know, with, like, my family and my neighbors, you know, because I'd always see my dad, you know, and he would always be, like, a little bit grumpy, but as soon as he'd have a couple of beers, he would loosen up, and I would, you know, my fear of him would shed. Then I could go kind of hang around him, you know, because he was loosened up a little bit. And, you know, and I was already kind of like at the age of 8, you know, I was already pretty well sure of the fact that I had a big fear of being poor. You know, I don't know what it was. I heard a speaker once say that, you know, he felt like he was taken by the mothership out of his original family and set in with another family. And that's the way I felt. I'm, like, hanging out with this family of mine, these three older sisters and these parents, and I have no idea what I'm doing in this family. I mean, at the age of eight, I didn't even like my dad or my mom at this point in time either. You know, I mean, they were pretty, you know, I just didn't know them, and I didn't feel like I fit in at all, you know, and you know, and I was always described as a very anxious kid. You know, and I was prone to, like, physical outbursts. I mean, it was nothing for me to be, like, first grade trying to punch a hole in a cinder block, you know, because I was so frustrated and I had no idea what I was doing, you know, and I was very confused all the time. I always use this line, but I pretty much played with myself all the time, you know, and I, you know, which meant that for me, you know, I mean, I was hanging out and I was playing with my G.I. Joes, you know, and I was playing with my matchboxes, and, you know, and I didn't want anybody else around me. I had no friends, and I pretty much, that was it. Well, at the age of 8, two of my older sisters were twins, and they graduated high school, so my parents did what every parent wants to do. They'd throw them a kegger. So, you know, they're having this party, you know, and they pretty much told me at this point in time that you get this 8-pack of malt duck. Now, for all of you that maybe don't know what malt duck is, it's like this great flavored beer type liquid. They come in these little 8-ounce nip bottles. And they told me that I could drink as many of these as I wanted, you know, during this party this night. Well, I'd like to say that this was my first drink of alcohol, but photographic evidence proves that my first drink was at 9 months, and it was a Pabst Blue Ribbon. Because my mom saw this picture, and she's proud of it, where I'm sitting on my dad's knee watching the Oakland Raiders, and I'm hitting a PBR. You know what I'm saying? And I still remember sometimes as a kid, you know, like, we didn't have cough syrup, so Seagram 7 was always a good cough syrup remedy, you know, so... You know, and I was already kind of like feeling, I didn't feel the effect of the alcohol. I just kind of knew that it was kind of cool that I was doing this stuff, you know. So here I am, I'm at this party, you know, and I'm looking around and I see the cool kids, you know, like all the girls are over here and they're making their like little girl noises, you know, and glancing over at the guys and stuff. And, you know, and the guys are over here and there's a motorcycle guy and he has a leather coat on. He has a long hair. I mean, REO Speedwagon is jamming at this point. You know, and he is it. He is the cool guy. He's the one that all the chicks want. And all his, like, little crony buds are all over there, and they're doing their cool guy thing. You know what I'm saying? Drinking back their beers. And I'm sitting on this picnic table, and I hammer down this first malt duck. And it's just like, I like the taste of it, you know. For me, malt duck, hey, it was like grape Kool-Aid with a fizz. And I hammer this first one down. And, you know, and I'm just sitting there, and I pop open the second one, and I'm starting to hit that one. And the guy with the motorcycle jacket comes over to me. He's just like, hey, man. He's like, you drink like a man. Why don't you come over and hang out with us? And something happened. But I was just like, wow. You know? Sure, I'll go hang out with you guys, you know? And I went over there, and a couple of malt ducks later, you know, I mean, I don't know what happened. But all of a sudden, you know, my parents not being good enough, my fear of being poor, you know, what everybody else thought of me, you know, being the dumpy fat kid, you know, didn't matter. It, all of a sudden, it just kind of went away. All of a sudden, I became funny, I think, for the first time, and outgoing to people around me for the very first time. You know, and I mean, you know, and I don't remember if I thought this, but I'm sure I was thinking, where has this been all my life? Because, you know, it truly was my first spiritual experience. Alcohol did for me what I could not do for myself. It made me part of the human race. And, you know, and that was the greatest, I mean, for me, I chased that illusion for the rest of my drinking career until I was 33 years old. And I like to say that I hit the bullseye on that first try because, you know, granted the next day I woke up puking and all that stuff and, you know, coming out of a blackout, hearing about all the crazy stuff that I had done. And, but still, though, you know, I'll never forget, you know, that total overwhelming joy that I had at that moment in time. And, you know, I basically just went on with my life, you know. I mean, I didn't think about drinking a lot at that point in time growing up. But I knew that whenever the opportunity came up, I sure as heck was going to take one and maybe two, you know. So, you know, even though I had that very first good drunk experience and I did drink the blackout, you know, I wasn't really obsessing about it right away. I went on about my life, which was going to school and doing stuff like that. You know, but still up to this point, I wasn't making too many friends and doing all that stuff. And something strange happened. My grandmother died of cirrhosis. So my grandfather, who was, you know, pretty sick, dying of alcoholism himself, had to be moved in. So one of my chores around the house was over the weekends I would go bar hopping with my grandfather, you know, basically to keep him out of trouble. Now, in Pennsylvania, we don't have, like, nice bars. We have honky-tonks. We have, you know, like, places that you just go and you drink. And there might be a pool table and there might be a jukebox with, like, seven songs on it. But this is what we used to do. I used to go around with my grandfather and pretty much, you know, it was a decoy for my grandfather not to let him get that drunk because he had me with him. You know, so my mom, in her own mystique way, like, was trying to control my grandfather's drinking by sending me along with him. So, you know, I used to spend my weekends in these bars, and I used to, like, look around at all these people, you know, and just be like, good God, you know, look at this waste of life. Man, I mean, God. Don't ever let me be like one of these damn people. You know what I'm saying? And I'll tell you what, I don't know how I made it out alive sometimes, because I mean, I remember my grandfather just getting sick on himself and almost wrecking cars on the way home, and I'd just be like petrified. And I mean, oh my God, you know, and I went through this thing like, dang, you know, like alcohol, that's some bad stuff, you know. At this point in time, you know, I see a lot of consequences from my parents' drug and alcohol abuse going on, and I'm like, this is all pretty whacked out. And, you know, but I just went along with my life. And something kind of weird, I guess my hormones kicked in a little earlier than everybody else, but right around 15, 16 years old, I was the beneficiary of a lot of facial hair. You know, I grew really fast at this point in time, and little did I realize that I was getting served. You know, because I just started hanging out with my sisters and, you know, still watching my grandfather slowly drink himself to death. And I just went out with my sisters one night, and I went to this bar, still the shy guy, and the bartender didn't know any better, but started serving me. So here I am, I'm in this bar, it's a Saturday night, and there's music jamming, a band playing, my sisters are all having fun, and I'm drinking. And I'm just like, wow, this is pretty cool again. You know, because, I mean, all of a sudden, you know, these people are coming up to me, you know, the girlfriends of my sisters are all like, hey, you know, and I'm like, sweet, you know, and all of a sudden I became like a nice-looking, fun guy, you know, and I, you know, all of a sudden I was playing better pool, and I was just like doing good, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, once again, you know, like alcohol reemerged in my life again, and, you know, and from this point on, I think alcohol pretty much defined me from that point on. Because with me getting served meant that I was the only guy in my high school that had access to booze anytime he wanted. In fact, I was getting served at the liquor store at 17. And I mean, that meant that I was the man on campus. I went from being the fat guy who basically nobody ever wanted to hang around with to president of my class in a year. I threw all the best parties. If anybody had a party, I was the number one guy. And alcohol defined me that way. You know, and it did. You know, I mean, all of a sudden I had to prom queen his girlfriend, and my life was great. I mean, it was great. I had all these things that I watched everybody else have, and all of a sudden I had them. And, you know, and I just thought, you know, that I had a twist of good luck at this point. But alcohol definitely made me what I was at that point. And, you know, needless to say, you know, my life just carrying on. I graduated high school and went off to college. I graduated with a pretty good, you know, grade point average and got accepted on my first try to Penn State University. And between 18 and 19 and a half, I got 7 underage drinking fines. And for most people, that might be a billboard that you might not want to drink, or you might want to try and not to drink. But for me, these were minor inconveniences on the road, because I was still, you know, I thought of myself, I was the man, you know. And these were all minor inconveniences that were just trying to hinder me from having fun. But I'm going to have fun anyway, because, you know what, I'm going to get my way. And that's the way I thought about it. And at this point in time, I'm already, like, stepping on people's toes. I'm treating women very badly at this point in time. Treating my parents, which I pretty much outcast them from my life at this point as well. And, you know, needless to say, a year and a half into college, I was out. I mean, Penn State threw me out of college. And so here I am, and I just don't know what to do once again. So, I don't know. You know, I'm hanging around my hometown, and all of a sudden the partying's just not as much fun as it used to be anymore. People were starting to get a little worried about hanging out with Merv, because generally, wherever I went, there was always some kind of destruction, or there was something going on, or something bad would happen, or the police would come, and it was all because of generally something that I did. And I kept saying to myself, this is just, I'm just starting to have a little string of bad luck here. Don't worry about it. Everything's going to get better. Well, it didn't get better. In fact, I didn't have any friends left in that town. So I did what any young alcoholic would do. I moved to another one, and I moved up to New York for a while, and got a DUI at 21, got a little bit more heavy consequences coming at me, and it, you know, just got, I don't know, you know, I mean, I was still having fun, But all of a sudden, I started feeling a little anxious again. You know, I started feeling a little depressed here and there. And, you know, I was kind of aware at this point that, you know, drinking was starting to become maybe a little bit of a problem. And I was also aware of the fact that if I had a couple, that meant I was generally, that was it. I was generally on the go from that point on. And generally about this time, too, you know, I don't like to talk a lot about it, but this is where marijuana and other drugs came into play a lot in my life. Because, you know, I soon found that if I was doing these other drugs, somehow or another, my drinking would ease up enough that I wouldn't get into all that trouble, you know? So this started a big, long line of using drugs to help me to try and control the amount of alcohol that I would take to keep the consequences off my back. So later, right before I turned 22, I basically get scampered out of New York by a couple of girls and a boss who fired me. And I didn't know what to do, so I went to Savannah, Georgia, and I bought a bar. Yeah. So I'm like in Savannah, Georgia, and once again, more highlights. I mean, Merv highlights. It was working. I was the man once again. And, you know, the consequences were at bay, simply because, A, I didn't have to drive anywhere. And, B, you know, I was an owner of a bar, which meant I could get in as much trouble as I wanted. So, granted, if I would have been in a different circumstance, I'm sure I would have been in a lot of trouble. But I still got into trouble anyway because 9 months later, I basically drank myself out of it. We went belly up. So that was it. So, I don't know. My life just kept on going that way, you know, ups and downs and ups and downs. And I don't know, you know, I'll try and keep this a little shorter. And I don't know. I moved to Charlottesville. And, you know, after just starting to feel a little, you know, anxious about my life, you know, I want to make a different move once again. So I come to Charlottesville and I'm bartending at a Ruby Tuesdays here in town. And I mean, I'm stealing from this place, and I'm like stealing money and out of the till, and I'm drinking on the job, you know, but you know, I'm covering my tracks pretty good at this point, but I'm still like not really liking my life too much. And you know, and I meet a new girl, and it's a new waitress, and it's a, and I don't know what she's doing hanging out with me anyway, because she's a nice girl. Generally, all my women up to date have been pretty much people that are kind of, you know, hanging out, that like to hang out in these sort of places like me. And so our first date, I decided, is going to be when I take my bar staff to Smith Mountain Lake. So we're down there for a day and a half, and the soon-to-be wife of mine, you know, is down there on the deck, and she's watching me, and I know she's watching me already, like how much I'm drinking. So needless to say, every time that she would, I would be drinking some Rolling Rock, and this is really weird, but she would go to the bathroom or go water skiing, and then I'd be hitting some Jaegers and just be like, bam, 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 just to get myself cool enough, calm enough, just to, like, be the man and be cool with this girl that I like. And it was a heck of a first date. I fell off my jet ski, and I got hit in the head by an oncoming jet ski going 50 miles an hour. I got heliported to the hospital, and I laid unconscious for 30 days. And when I came out of that, you know, I had no idea what was going on. My jaw was wired shut. It was busted in four places. And my head was held together by stitches and a plate. And I came to, and there's this girl sitting beside me. And I'm just like, darn, I'm messing up. And for the first time, I said the words, you know, and I meant it. I never want to drink again. And I told her, I said, I don't want to drink again. And, you know, I had nowhere to go at this point either, because Ruby Tuesdays didn't want me back, my roommates didn't want me back, and I just didn't know what to do. Fortunately for me, my best friend and his sister, who was a nurse, decided that they needed to come down and get me, and they lived in Winchester, Virginia. So they came down and got me out and moved me in up there with them, and I mean, I meant it. I wasn't going to drink again, and 2 days later, I was drunk, and you know, and it was just kind of like, I still remember just like as I'm stealing liquor out of one of their friends' house, just like, man, what am I doing? What am I doing? And that's kind of sums up the rest of my drinking career. You know, I got back on my feet went back to work bartending, made boatloads of money in West Virginia, of all places. But I made a lot of money in West Virginia. And, paid back some medical bills, went up, moved in with this woman that stayed with me at the hospital. And together we made a lot of money. And I kept thinking to myself, I was like, well, you know, if I get married and I can get that house that I want, and I get that picket fence, you know what, maybe I'm going to be happy. You know, maybe there is a chance that I could be happy. At this point, I'm still trying to drink manageably. I'm trying to control it a little bit, you know, at this point, because I don't want to lose this girl. And, we get married. We get the house. We got the dog, and we're talking about having a kid. We have retirement, early retirement, starting to go in the bank. And, you know, and I'm sitting there, you know, miserable. I'm just miserable. Because up to this point, you know, I was trying to control my drinking, which meant just having a couple here and there, smoking a lot of that non-habit-forming marijuana, and just trying to get by. And I just started getting miserable. And I started getting, not getting out of bed depressed. You know, I had a couple of days like that, you know, and I was just like, man, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? And, and I don't know. The day came when I drank, and I drank a lot. In fact, I drank so much I got a DUI, and I wrecked a car. And I think at this point, this is car number 5 up total. And she's like looking at me like, I'm just like, hey, I was partying, it got out of control, it was just an accident. She's just like, all right. Another week later, I get another DUI in Pennsylvania, trying to visit my parents. And I come back home, and she's like, you got to stop. And I said, you're right. So I checked myself into Region 10 outpatient, and I'm, like, hanging out. You know, and they're starting to give me, like, a lot of, like, you know, information about alcoholism. But I'm just looking at them like, you guys don't understand. You know, that might work for you guys, but you don't understand. You know, I said, you know, I don't know, you know, what I'm doing. But, you know, I'm going to try and control this thing as best as I could. Because, I mean, A, I was scared to death of losing everything I had. You know, and I kept thinking that, you know, if I just put my best effort forward, that somehow I can lick this thing. You know, somehow or another, something's going to happen where this is all finally just going to end. And I kept thinking these thoughts. And, so at this point in time, now I'm not drinking. And I'm just slowly, I don't know, eating away. I mean, I don't talk to anybody anymore. I mean, I'm quitting a series of jobs at this point. I can't even hold a job at a record store or a coffee shop. And, I mean, I'm starting to struggle. And, and it's just, you know, pretty evident to me that I'm going to have to drink. So for the next year of my life, I switched off. I never liked vodka. I thought it was the nastiest stuff on the face of the planet, but that became my new best friend. Because I figured, you know, if I can hide it from the wifey poo, you know, everything will be okay. And for, I don't know, next 9 months to a year, my favorite cocktail was getting a six-pack of Zima, because nobody could smell Zima, put it all in a pitcher, and put in a half a bottle of vodka, and probably about this much out of a bottle of Listerine, put it all in a pitcher, stir it up, wait for the wifey poo to go to bed, and then hammer that thing down. And that's what I did every night for like 9 months. And just to kind of stay somewhat focused and then yet achieve what I so desperately wanted to do. Because I, at this point in time, drinking didn't make me happy anymore. All it did was just get me through. And I wasn't happy at all. But the one thing that whenever I got to that point right before blackout, right before oblivion, I was able to consciously just kind of shed all that stuff that's going on in my head. And that's what I had to do. I mean, during the day, I'd just be like, oh, God, you know, and I could just feel this tension in my chest, like just boiling up, you know, and I just need to drink. I just need to drink, you know, but I just would hold off every night until she'd go to bed, and then I'd hammer that thing down, and all right, I can hang. I can hang. And it just kept going on and on. And once again, you know, even this maladjusted attempt at trying to control my drinking didn't last forever. Because I don't know what it was. I just basically, my parents had a tree fall on their trailer. And they called me up, and they, for the first time, they asked me for help. And I said, all right, I'm coming up for help. And, you know, and I was like, I'm going up to help them out. And I didn't even make it across the Virginia line. Got drunk. And I got a DUI. One more. Number three. And I'm just freaking out at this point. This is my third one. I'm not supposed to be drinking. I go back home, and she's just, like, looking at me like, you're insane. You are insane. And I'm just, like, so hating myself at this point. I'm so depressed, and, you know, and I just don't know what's going on. But I know that, you know, this has got to end. And the day my childhood hero, Willie Stargell, died, I decided that that bridge up on 33, up on top of that mountain, was where this was the day. And, you know, I called in sick because my back was out. And at this point in time, I'm working at a prestigious law firm in Charlottesville. I'm managing $25 million a year. And I just said, screw it. And I basically went, drank a bunch of Jägermeister, got my little handheld recorder, and started just babbling crap out and crying behind the wheel. And I went up and I hit that guardrail 55 miles an hour, and somehow or another my car bounced straight back. And I did it, and when all this went down, I was in a blackout, and the cops, like, were telling me this, like, the next day. I mean, I come to, and I'm out of a blackout once again in a jail cell, and I am furious. I am clinically psychotic at this point. I am kicking the door. I mean, I am yelling at the top of my lungs, A, that I'm still alive, and B, that, you know, I just can't believe it. I just snapped. The wife came and got me out of jail the next day. And, you know, there was no word said. We went back to the house, and I just didn't know what to do. And at this point in time, I'd been kind of hanging out around Alcoholics Anonymous. I was sitting in the back of meetings and, you know, and get there right before the prayer and, you know, and scamper out right after the Lord's Prayer. And, God, I hated the meetings that ended with the Lord's Prayer because I like the Serenity Prayer so I could quick run out, you know, and get in my car and drink vodka the whole way home, you know, and just to kind of, you know, keep it all together. And, you know, and I don't know, you know, too much about Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, I didn't have too much trust for anybody in here, you know. I didn't really believe that you guys, I believed that what you guys were doing was working for you, but I had this big, severe case of my case is different. And I truly believed that my case was different. Because at this point, after the wife throws me out and says, I want a divorce and I'm keeping everything, you're out of here, I went home to Pennsylvania and I saw my first psychiatrist and he said, guess what? You are bipolar depressed. And I said, you know what? You are absolutely right. And he gave me a couple of scripts. And, you know, and basically at that point in time, I knew I was right. You know, I wasn't just like you people. I had other problems, too. And I come back down here, and I check myself into another treatment facility. And I'm like, you know, in there getting a head full of knowledge, they're right. And they're telling me that, yes, you are bipolar. You need to stay on this stuff. They're telling me stuff about my inner child, you know, and all that type of wacky stuff. And I'm just like, man, I'm screwed up. You know, come to find out, too, I have, like, a sex love addiction, you know, and I have, like, all this other stuff, you know, going on. So when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had six different diagnoses of what was wrong with me. And I was pretty sure that they were right. So I get out of this first step treatment center. And, you know, I have my relapse prevention plan in my hand, and I'm drunk. I'm drunk the next day. I mean, I'm drunk, and I'm just, like, waking up out of a blackout again in the jail cell with urine all over me, and I'm just like, why? Why am I here? You know, and I am losing it at this point. You know, because at this point in time, I got a sponsor, and I'm trying to do the steps, and I'm just like, is this not working? You know, and you know, I just didn't know what to do, so I just decided that I might as well just get good and drunk and just see what happens. And within a week, I was back in that same jail cell. My second blackout arrest, drunk in public, and I come to. And, you know, I don't know what's up. So I start walking back to town from jail, and I stop at this store to go in and get a 22-ounce bottle of Budweiser, and I go in and I get it. And, I mean, I'm just pathetic looking. I mean, the person behind the counter is just looking at me like, you know, she knows I just got out of jail. And I got that 22-ounce, and I went back behind the dumpster, and I took a couple of big swallows, and I just proceeded to get sick all over myself. And I just walked back to town. And I walked into this 5:30 speaker meeting. And you know what? I didn't know it then, but at that point in time, I had surrendered. I went into that meeting, and, you know, and I just said, I will do whatever you people in AA tell me to do. I've had enough. And, you know, and the funny thing was, is about a week beforehand, you know, heard this person speak in Alcoholics Anonymous. I completely loathed for my 2.5, 3 years of being around the rooms of AA. You know, they had the big book, like, with their name on the front, like, stenciled in leather, you know, and when they were sharing in meetings, they were always talking about God, and, you know, and talking about, you know, acting better than you feel, whatever, you know. But they said one thing that stuck in my head, which was, you never have to drink again if you do these certain things. And I looked at them funny when they said that. But that was the only thing I remembered. And I called that person up, and I said, I need some help. And they came and got me. They had big plans. They had a lot of stuff going on in their life at that point in time, but they halted everything, and they came and got me. Took me out to this house. And it was no, like, you know, getting in touch with your inner child or anything like that. They said, we're going to start reading out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we started with the doctor's opinion, and we went through. And, you know, the information in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous was awesome. The doctor's opinion, every time I read it, I get more and more out of it. But we started talking about things like the allergy to alcohol. Thank you, Sam. And, you know, and this person just started talking about their experience of, like, you know, when you have one or two, do you generally drink more than you want to, or do you, like, go out and say, no, you're only going to have two or three, but then end up closing the bar that night again, you know? And we would talk about our experience about how that would happen. Like, for me, you know, I mean, I would have, like, you know, sometimes I'd be able to have, like, two beers and then, you know, smoke a bunch of pot and then go to bed early. But for the most time, if I was drinking, I was generally, like, you know, at 2 in the morning, like, asking everybody where they were going next, you know, and once again, you know, I'd wake up the next day all next to death. But that's just the way it went for me. And then we talked about the obsession of the mind, which is basically, for me, you know, I can stop anytime I want, but how long can I stay stopped? And once again, this person shared their experience with that with me, and it was very similar to mine, which was, for me, the best I got was 20 days. You know, basically since I was like 16 years old. And you know, we just started talking. And soon to realize, you know, after getting through Bill's story, that this person is exactly like me. We drink exactly the same. And from talking about how they felt without alcohol, come to realize that, you know, I don't have six different diagnoses. I have one. And I'm an alcoholic. And, you know, and I'm just, like, looking at this person, you know, and I'm just thinking, and I'm looking at them, and they're sober, but more importantly, they're happy and sober at the same time, which for me, I had never had those two feelings happen simultaneously before. I'm looking at them, and all of a sudden, you know, for the first time, and I don't know, you know, if it was, like, God shooting a lightning bolt into my heart or what, but I know now it was hope. Because all of a sudden I just felt relieved, you know. Hey, I know what the problem is now, and I'm looking at this person who did the solution. And it's just like, wow, you know, if I really do what this person tells me to do, I can be happy and sober too. And that was it for me. I was sold on Alcoholics Anonymous right then and there on the spot. We went through the big book, and I followed the directions. If it said it was required, I did it. If there was a question, I answered it. And I basically followed through the steps of AA. I did a very imperfectly fourth step. In fact, I didn't even finish the last two columns on my fourth step. But I went ahead and I did the business anyway. I fifth stepped it. Six and seven took all but an hour for me. My eighth step list was already ready, and they had me out making amends at 30 days sober. And I'm glad that they had a sense of urgency with me, because I think I used up all my free time. That there wasn't any, a lot of people I see in AA, they're so lucky they get that grace period that they get to hang out, and think about it for a while before they have to do it. For me, I was so desperate when I came here, and it was very clear to me that this was a life or death situation. And I think it was very clear to the people who sponsored me too. So they said, let's just go ahead and knock it out. And I started doing amends, and I look back at it, and when I was making my amends, and it was just kind of weird. I didn't even recognize it when it happened, but right after the fifth step, that whole obsession to drink went away. It's not like because I spent so much time with trying to wish it away and work on it and do all these things, but it just kind of went away. I didn't even notice it. Maybe it was because I was doing so many meetings and doing stuff like that, but it was very clear to me that that my inner bursting that I always had to drink away wasn't there anymore. And for me, that was another proof to me that there was a God out there and it was working in my life as long as I was doing these things. So I went along with Alcoholics Anonymous, and at this point in time, I'm hooked up, which is basically, I got passed on to a sponsor that was up in northern Jersey. And I had a long distance kind of communique with this person. And this person was a little bit rigid as far as different ideas concerning Alcoholics Anonymous. One of those ideas, that were influenced on me were basically stuff like, you have to make amends to everybody on your eight-step list, which for me meant that they told me to go ahead and put all my amends down on 3x5 cards, and I had a stack of close to 300. So I'm sitting there trying to make these amends, and I'm looking at this stack of 300 amends cards, and I'm starting to feel pressure. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm never going to get this stuff done. They started telling me stuff like, you're going to drink again if you don't do these things. And all of a sudden, the pressure's on me again. I don't want to put them down because they took me through the steps and they got me to where I was now. But there was a lot of sponsorship in the lines of like, you cannot see this person in a relationship. You need to discard these people in your life. And there was a lot of managing my life going on around me. And I got very uncomfortable with that. And in fact, to the point where I went on this spree of trying to change sponsors. And looking for a sponsor in Charlottesville is kind of tough. So I bebopped around to a different couple of people. And this one guy, who was supposed to be a heavy hitter, I seen him just berate people in a parking lot and just make them feel totally bad about themselves. And I'm like, I don't want this guy as a sponsor. And I felt myself starting to get goofier because at this point in time, I'm making amends without any kind of sponsorship guide, and I'm starting to wreck them. I'm not even considering, just my own, basically what my harms were and leaving their harms alone. I was telling them about their harms and letting them know that my harms were basically, coming back from what they actually did to me. So I wrecked a lot of amends sponsoring myself in this time period. And desperation started to get a hold of me once again. The obsession wasn't on me, but all of a sudden, I started remembering that alcohol did take care of my problems in the past. And I was fully aware that if I had one, I was going to be dead very soon. And this girl that I started seeing, was pretty funny about it, but she said, you're a pretty desperate guy, and I know this guy down in Buckingham who takes on desperate cases like yourself. So I went down and I talked to this guy, and he instilled in me some immediate relief. Because at this point, Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm still an alcoholic and an addict. You know, I flake around and I just go to meetings whenever I want. And basically, I was in a little bit of trouble, even though I didn't think so at the time. And I think probably the toughest thing for me at this point in time in this recovery program was the emphasis that my previous sponsor had put on a spiritual awakening. They were telling me things like doing 30 prayers a day, 40 minutes of meditation twice a day, and listening for God to speak at all points in time. So I'm like running around my little world, you know, waiting for God to give me signs, you know. And if I see a matchbook, I pick it up. I'm like, sign from God, sign from God, you know. And there was a lot of emphasis put on the second step proposition where, you know, is God everything or is God nothing? What's your choice to be? And it was, you know, and it was just like every time I had a problem, it's like, well, you know, is God everything? You know, and I'm like, I don't know, I guess so, you know, but that didn't help me out, you know, and I'm like freaking out. And worst of all, my ego has already rebuilt itself to this point in Alcoholics Anonymous at 9 months sober where I think I'm a spiritual giant because I'm doing these things. And I'm telling people in AA just exactly what they're not doing right. And I'm burying myself. And all of a sudden, I'm prey to misery and depression once again, in sobriety, doing amends. And I just don't know what's wrong again. So she told me to go down and see this guy. And I talked with him. And he said pretty much that we're going to have to reorganize your Alcoholics Anonymous life. And the first thing we talked about was, you know, what's your primary purpose in Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, I don't know, find out what God wants me to do. And he said, the primary purpose will tell you what God wants you to do. He wants you to, you know, carry a clear and concise message of Alcoholics Anonymous to the person who still suffers. And he said, you know, there's a lot of stuff that needs to be done in AA. And for people, you know, that come into AA, it seems like they always get to this point where, you know, either AA becomes, you know, a whole portion of their life, or A is something that they do, you know, around their life. And, you know, he said, alcoholics like yourself that the book describes, you're going to need the primary purpose in your life. And it sounded like some good information to me, but it didn't hit home right away. I started doing things that this gentleman suggested to me, which was get set meetings. You know, I had 5 meetings a week, and 4 of those I showed up to every week. He told me to get a home group and get a job in that home group. And I was like, okay, you know. And I got a temporary home group until I could get a car to get to Buckingham. So I got a temporary home group and I got a job in that home group. And, you know, and I just, you know, I don't know. For some reason, I just got kind of caught in this structure of Alcoholics Anonymous. At this point in time, I'm starting to sponsor people. And, you know, I'm starting to realize that whenever I'm working with another alcoholic that I see more of myself in there than I do see in them, you know. And I come to find out that, you know, there's other things that I had always thought that I could work on my problems, that I could work on my character defects. But it comes to pass that these are things that God will take away from me when he sees them fit. You know, so I didn't have to put any more pressure on myself about working on my problems anymore. And another thing, too, that really kind of got a lot of pressure off my back was the fact that Alcoholics Anonymous can solve all my problems, just not my alcohol problems. And, you know, and I just started staying in this structure of AA. And for the first time, I really became willing to do whatever this person would tell me to do. And I just stayed stuck in it. And, you know, and slowly but surely, you know, sayings like, act better than you feel did come into my, you know, how I act in my life. Things like how you feel is not how you're doing spiritually started to sink in a little bit deeper because I always thought how I felt equaled how I was doing spiritually. You know, I didn't realize the fact that if I felt like crap, you know, that I could be just as spiritual as anybody else. Because before, you know, thinking that how I felt was how I was being spiritual, little did I realize that the best I can be spiritual today is how I act. Because if I feel like down and out and I'm self-centered and I want to tell everybody what exactly is wrong with them and I'm scared to death of what this person's thinking of me, spirituality isn't how I feel, it's how I act. You know, if I'm looking down at this person, then all of a sudden I realize that now this is an equal person of the human race. I need to treat them accordingly. I will act in a spiritual manner. And for the most part, that's as good as I'm going to get. And I kept having all these high ideas of how You know, I was going to be this person who's going to be able to go around and put my hand on alcoholics' shoulders and get them sober. And what did I realize? That wasn't going to work. So I stay in the structure of Alcoholics Anonymous, and slowly but surely my life starts to get better once again. I have spurts of weeks in a row where I actually feel good, you know. And generally for me, you know, it's just kind of wacky, but whenever I look back on it, you know, I'll never forget the first sponsee I ever had. And it's like right at 10 months sober. And working with this guy, you know, I'll never forget the ease and comfort that came into my mind after working with this guy was almost exactly like it was for drinking, you know, for me. Because it got me out of my head, you know. And working with this guy, like all of a sudden, you know, my little peddling problems didn't amount to a hill of beans compared to this guy. I mean, because I always thought I had it bad, you know. But then whenever you get out in the fire lines of Alcoholics Anonymous, I realized that I didn't have it bad at all. You know, not compared to some of these guys. So, anyways, you know, I have to preach the word of a structured environment in Alcoholics Anonymous simply because it saved my butt on many occasions. I had a son. I have a new girlfriend. I went from a law firm job to being a dishwasher. So I have all these things on my plate. You know, I want to be a dad. I want to be a good dad. I got to ditch this dishwashing job, which has turned into a waiter job. I got to get rid of that, and I got to go back, and I got to get a 9-to-5 job again. You know, and all these things started popping up in my head. And all of a sudden, the primary purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous was no longer in my head because Merv became my primary purpose again. And I got distracted from Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I was going to meetings, and I could put on a good show for what I was sharing, and, you know, I could always, like, boost my ego, you know, and make sure that I was always right about something when I shared an AA meeting, but pretty much I was out of there. I wasn't sticking around after a meeting to shake a newcomer's hand or talk to him after a meeting. I was out of there because I had things I had to get done in my life. And, you know, and me and my girlfriend start not getting along, and I'm, like, whining to my sponsor, and, you know, and I'm just like, hey, man, you know, she's X amount of years sober. She should be she should be more spiritual. She's sick. You know, she's only going to 3 meetings a week. She's a sick alcoholic. My sponsor's just looking at me like, whoa. Until finally, my sponsor probably did the most spiritual thing he's ever done for me, put a gag order on me. I wasn't allowed to speak about my relationships anymore, about my peddly job. He said, I only want to know about what you're doing in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I had nobody to whine to, you know. And what did I realize that, you know, with my primary purpose laying back on Merv being my primary purpose, that all of a sudden my belief and trust in God had turned out to be a belief and trust in my sponsor. And I had to take a long, hard look at myself during that gag period, you know. And what exactly was I doing with my 10th and 11th step every day? And, you know, and it came very clear because I was in my home group. I'm reading this passage one more time. And it's the actor who wants to run the show. And I'm, like, sitting there in this meeting, and all of a sudden I heard it. And I'm like, oh, my God, I am the actor trying to run the show. Right, before, you know, when they're talking about the third step, I mean, the manipulation and the passive aggressiveness, you know, that the director tries to use to get his actors to act right, or the actors tries to do, you know, to get his fellow actors and his peers to act right. You know, sometimes, you know, being nice to him to get what he wants is sometimes being mean. And I looked at that and I was like, oh my God, that's me and my relationship. You know. And we went back through the steps, and those last two columns that I missed in my first go around, we read the part about, you know, how we have to pray for sick people. You know, and not only that, but the little segment like where they're talking about, like, you know, we disregard the other person's actions entirely and we take a look at ourselves. And all these things started sinking in, and once I did an inventory on this situation, I got very clear that I was the problem. And, you know, I went on and I made amends to this woman. And, you know, I still have ongoing amends. And it was just a redirection of my life. I may have gotten distracted from Alcoholics Anonymous, but the whole thing is that the structure base of Alcoholics Anonymous, the structure that I was in, saved my butt. because, you know, I was still going to meetings. I was still talking to my sponsor. I was still saying yes to anything Alcoholics Anonymous would have asked me to do. And, you know, I just got through it. And I had a great experience. Because, you know, it's been my fortune and pleasure since I've transcended this, and now I'm in a great relationship with this woman, and we have a 3-year-old son now, that now I'm able to help other, or work with other alcoholics, and not necessarily in a sponsorship level, but just talking to them or going through the same exact thing. You know, so I think that was a great experience for me to have in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think every experience is. Because, I don't know, there's no garbage in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's all gold. Because all that crap that I went through and all that crap I put my parents through that I had to go back and make amends for, all that stuff has come back around. And now all of a sudden, you know, the primary purpose is back in my life. And everything that I thought was garbage, I used to dwell on in a negative sense, has now all become a positive attribute in my life. You know, I just can't thank Alcoholics Anonymous enough. You know, I do have a, you know, I do have a sense of gratitude. But for me, I always have to remember how to show my gratitude, which is accepting requests to come and speak. You know, if somebody needs a ride, you know, I'm willing to try and give them a ride. Or if anybody just needs to go have a cup of coffee and talk, you know, that's for me is how I show my gratitude for Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, my life today is nowhere near perfect. You know, but the thing is like, I don't know. I think one of the greatest benefits of AA in my life is that I can actually more than not show some kind of courteous nature towards my fellow man. You know, there's a phrase in our home group that, you know, thank God we don't act like we think, you know, and for me that's so true. You know, for whenever I'm looking at that person who's tipping me a dollar on $40, and I look at him and I just want to strangle him. But I say thank you very much, and I invite him back. And, you know, for me, that's not me. You know, that's the power of God that I found through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous working in my life. And, you know, there is always that part of me that always wants to take credit for everything that I do in AA, but I know none of it is, I can't take any kind of credit at all. Because it's the people that came before me that passed their, you know, experience on to me. And also, you know, basically coming to trust God occasionally, you know, that my life has progressed in a better way. And, you know, I can only wish that, you know, that everybody who comes to Alcoholics Anonymous gets it. And from my experience, I know that doesn't happen on the first try. So I feel, you know, along with my primary purpose, I might be the hated person with my name logoed on my book sometime. That probably says stuff in meetings that people don't like, but I'm willing to stand up for what I believe in. Just for that one person, it might come along just like myself, that it just might stick in their head, and maybe they'll call. So, Billy Hill, thank you very much for having me come down and share tonight. And it's been my pleasure to talk with y'all.